Welcome to the LaRouche Show. This is June 3rd, 2006. It's Saturday. You know, we're the weekly LaRouche Show on the publication of Lyndon LaRouche, that is Executive Intelligence Review News Service at www.larouchepub.com. And our topic for today, for the next hour, is going to be on going nuclear. That is nuclear power for the world, for the United States. What's happening, what isn't happening, what's the science, what's the political organizing drive connected to this, and what are the key retooling questions and gear-up questions for the industrial base that's been languishing for 40 years. Now, the way we have this show is an intercontinental dialogue. It is international. I will moderate from here in our studios at the LaRouche Show. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm with the economics team for EIR News Service. And we have from three, in fact, it may be four different locations today, guests who are extremely actively involved in organizing and the particulars of this matter of nuclear power. And I'm going to introduce them in just a moment, but as I want to stress, we're talking today, we have the opportunity to talk about nuts and bolts and design questions, what other countries are doing, what the United States is doing, what's the financial side of all of this, making it happen, and also what's the political side. And namely, that's where I want to give a few updates before I introduce our four guests. They will be from Argentina, Massachusetts, California, and probably someone on the road from the Midwest. But what we're talking about is that we need emergency federal intervention in the United States on the economy to actually make a shift away from this very rapid breakdown that you see in the auto sector in particular, where there are mass terminations of jobs, shutdowns of plants, and in fact auctioning off like a flea market sale of the guts of the industrial base of our country that's embodied in the auto plant sector of our country, namely machine tools. Now, you well know that we're in the midst of an action operation on this that in recent weeks Mr. Lyndon LaRouche has put out an emergency legislative package that is being mass circulated around the country, and Congress in Washington, D.C. resumes in 2 days. It will be in full session after the Memorial Day recess. And the urgency of what we face about the industrial capability of the United States, and which is, of course, a leading part of the world, is shown by the fact that last month, I mean in May, there were these kinds of eBay equivalent auctions for several plants. One of them was in California, the former General Motors parts plant named, restructured as Delphi about 4 years ago in Irvine, California. Its guts were just sold off. Ditto, the same kind of thing in Muncie, Indiana, where General Motors had had for 80 years one of the biggest transmission and gear plants in the entire world. Its entire complement of machine tools were sold off in an auction in mid-May for something like 15 cents on the dollar. So this just typifies the fact of how urgent the situation is that we have a policy shift. And the LaRouche Youth Movement in the United States has been intensively briefing offices on Capitol Hill in Washington, going to field meetings of certain congresspeople around the country. But in particular, we're in the season of party conventions. The Democratic Party has had a convention in California, in New York State, and other places. And this very weekend, there are many at once: New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Washington State, Maine and Indiana, for example. And in all of these cases, among other venues, the LaRouche Youth Movement and other organizers are drawing the line as to whether there's going to be nation-serving emergency policies or not. There's nothing else to talk about. During this show, we may have a quick report from someone, Steve Jeffrey is his name, the LaRouche Youth Movement, who has been in Indianapolis. He's literally in the car driving from there to Ohio to another destination. But what is happening with our organizing for taking emergency action on the part of the federal government is this is also part of exposing a particular kind of madness that's gripped the country in the face of the high gasoline prices and the general hyperinflation that's taking place. We have this mass turn to ethanol, gasohol, biodiesel, whatever you want to call it, corn cob power. And the I just want to point out that there are 50,000 off-prints being prepared right now for the time that Congress resumes this week in Washington, D.C., of the Executive Intelligence Review feature story that appeared last week called Ethanol Madness, End the Great 2006 Biofuels Swindle, that gives you the kind of what you need to know about how crazy this is, but and how, in fact, what's really needed is the modern power we were going towards 40 years ago, which is nuclear power. And the, in particular, what everyone should keep in mind is that on June 9th, that'll be this coming Friday, June 9th at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, based in the United States, will be an international webcast by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche on the strategic situation. We've been focusing, we're going to focus our dialogue today on energy and on nuclear power, but he will be, I am sure, giving the latest evaluation on the world's strategic situation and what should be done as of that time, because we have no time to lose. And that's where I ask everyone to, I'll repeat this later during the show, make sure you lay hands on this emergency legislative proposal by Mr. LaRouche. There's mass numbers of this, or you can get it off the internet. You know, he has the LaRouche Political Action Committee site, LPAC. Likewise, make sure you get this ethanol madness organizing material, and do everything possible for forcing the shift that's already underway in many parts of institutions, many individuals. I'll just tell you right now that there's over 100 people of current office holders in state legislatures, many trade union leaders, who have signed a statement urging federal action as in the way that we've been describing Mr. LaRouche is proposing, and also taking note of the fact that we have a blowout of the financial system, no time to lose. And this statement is in preparation for running as an advertisement in Washington, D.C. at the time of Congress's return. And this just shows the kind of motion that's underway that politically is something that we have to make sure succeeds. There's a very limited time when Congress remains in office. Keep that in mind, because it isn't lobbying as usual that we're doing. We need to have this initiative actually take shape, someone introduce it, and force the and we need to force the passage of it. So with that brief introduction, let me just give you an identification of our guests, and you'll see why we say we can have this dialogue, because to begin with, we have one of the answer men of the world, I'm going to call him that, on nuclear power. Welcome, Jim Muckerheider from Massachusetts. Hi.
Hi, Marcia.
Very good. And Mr. Muckerheider has been, I'll call you the activist's activist on nuclear power. I understand you're a nuclear engineer. You are the nuclear engineer for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Is that right?
That's right.
And I know over the decades you've had experience in one of the big construction firms. You've taught at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, maybe at other places. And I point out to people in particular that there is the 2005 article you wrote. It's in the summer issue of 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, and it's simply called How to Build 6,000 Nuclear Plants by 2050. That's for the world, and that sounds like a lot, and we'll be getting back to that soon. And from the West Coast, welcome Jason Ross.
Hello.
You're speaking from Los Angeles, and people know you from the LaRouche Youth Movement, and I'll say right now that you visited during this week, the place in Southern California that's part of the work for a fourth generation nuclear plant design. It's the one that's also shown, their schematic, in the DVD that LaRouche Political Action Committee put out on retooling for economic revival in the country and the world. Welcome from Buenos Aires, Betiana Gonzalez. How are you?
Hi, Marcia. I'm fine.
And Betiana from Argentina is going to be has a lot to say about what's going on in her nation and also an international event, June 15th, on nuclear power that's going to be centered in Mexico City and also in Buenos Aires. But first, Jason, maybe you could just go right ahead with any observations, what was striking about your tour of the nuclear R&D company.
Well, first off, just I don't know if people have an idea of what General Atomics does. It actually does a lot. The name obviously gives it away. They do a lot of work on nuclear, but also they had projects on maglev, the creation of hydrogen fuel from water, so that they're working on the all the aspects of the energy development there. And they make the Predator drone planes that fly around by remote control and shoot Hellfire missiles. So they do a lot of things. The first introduction we got to the nuclear power there was the fission section, where the head engineer of the energy group there was going through with us the fourth generation nuclear plant, the next generation nuclear plant, and the ability to create plants that could very, well, for one thing, be a high temperature plant, which is going to be important for the creation of hydrogen fuel, but also the kind of fuel that they would be able to use. I mean, they've got designs for plants that are able to use fuel, regular nuclear fuel. They can recycle nuclear fuel, something that we're not doing yet in the United States, or they could burn off plutonium from decommissioned nuclear weapons, which we and the Russians are decommissioning to reduce our stockpiles of nuclear weapons in that way. So, some of the statistics are pretty exciting. These higher temperature plants get a better efficiency because they're hot. And also, if you get a temperature of at least 850 degrees Celsius, you can have a different kind of technique for cracking apart water to get the hydrogen out of it for use of hydrogen as a fuel, which is about, I think from their numbers, it's about 2.5 times more efficient with this kind of plant versus the kinds of plants that we currently have. So it's very interesting that it's an interesting company because they'll make these programs and then they don't get built. Then they'll design more plants and they haven't been built. So it's kind of an interesting kind of optimism they've got. But also, it reflects the need that they have for a real political intervention. We also got a tour of the fusion research department of the company, where they've got the biggest privately owned tokamak in the world. If people don't know, a tokamak is a donut-shaped device where basically strong magnetic fields are used to isolate plasma with the idea of getting temperatures over 100 million degrees Celsius so that you can get fusion to occur. So, it's obviously in the, it's a research reactor. It's not commercially producing any energy. But, they're able to do the kinds of research that are going to be essential, which will be needed on a larger scale to finally make the breakthrough and get commercially viable fusion energy. So it's pretty awesome seeing something like that. There's only a few in the world, and we've got one here.
That's great. How many went with you, Jason?
It was five of us. One of the interesting things was that in our discussions with the people on the employees there was an incredible response to LaRouche's overall political initiatives, economic initiatives, obviously the creation of nuclear plants, but also in particular to the educational or epistemological goals of the LaRouche Youth Movement. In going through with these guys, the need to completely reform the way the educational system works in the United States and really in the world, these guys, we got a pretty strong ascent. And one of the guys was telling us that they take about 10 grad students per year, and that nowadays about probably 6, 7, 8 of them are foreign nationals. And it seemed like they'd obviously, just kind of indicating the inability, that people just aren't, Americans aren't either getting educated in these fields or either from not interest or from just an inadequate education. They're not even competent to get into these fields.
Right. Well, Jim, we wanted to turn it right over to you just to draw out any particular aspect, whether it's the fuels or the technology on the high temp, or what do you think about this?
Oh, I've been a fan of the high temperature gas reactor for many years. I was involved in some of the initial architect engineer design work when the large plants were sold by General Atomics before it got into its current form. Those plants were sold in the early 70s, and there were going to be about 8 or 10 that had already been sold when the need for power was really pretty much undercut with the oil shock in 73, 74, and the growth of demand for electric power had gone up 7% a year before that, and after that, it went up only 2 or 3%, and people thought it would recover, but it didn't. And then the projection for all of the plants that had been ordered, nuclear and coal, et cetera, were much greater than the demand for power. And the problem with the General Atomics plants at that time was that the plants would be only a few plants and would be very uneconomic to build a whole fuel development, fuel fabrication capability, and still be able to be affordable, because the whole premise had been built on the fact that they'd build dozens of them, not only 8 or 10. And so it was part of the early cancellation of plants that happened in the late 70s and early 80s. The modular idea came about because the large plants could still have meltdowns, but the small plants could not. And the idea behind that is that the kind of fuel particles that they use are wrapped in ceramic, so the fuel is only a tiny speck wrapped in ceramic material. And when there could be any reaction in that core, the heat that would be generated would dissipate at temperatures lower than would damage the ceramic fuel. So it couldn't be damaged, so there would be no release of radioactivity. So that's why those smaller sized plants are considered so important. They can't be damaged. The high temperature is important because current nuclear plants with oxide fuel boil water and run turbines at only moderate temperatures. The high temperatures can feed heat into process industries. And so the whole utilization of uranium as an energy source can go beyond just providing electricity. So those elements of that design, and the early designs go from the 50s. Early plants in the 60s and 70s were built on these particle fuel, ceramic fuel capabilities. So all of that's been done. But building the capacity to build them in quantity and to be more advanced in the way they're designed and operated is really critical to apply these plants, especially in areas of the world where very large plants aren't really good for the kind of electric systems they have, and that incremental additions of smaller units can be ideal for many developing and smaller systems in areas of developed countries.
Right. Well, let's bring a couple things out here then, since you're opening up a lot. One thing is, as is implied, there was the hiatus the United States has had. From 1967 to 1973, is that right, Jim, was when the last orders got filled for nuclear plants, so that we end up with 103 generators, nuclear generators in the United States today, but we have not been adding to them since then. Is that right?
Depending on how you count adding, because the plants that were ordered then were added over the years. The longest one was finally went online in 1996.
It was that in California?
No, I think that plant was in it was in the South and I forget which one it was.
So, in other words, there's 103 in the United States, and the world total at present is how many, Jim?
About 443.
And so, to these points you're opening up, that there, and Jason is saying, there are technologies, there are these highly safe, high-temperature, modular plants, there are other certified and fine plants. Would you just say something about how you would go from 440 now to your view 50 years from now or 45 years from now of why you would need 6,000 nuclear plants, and what are some of the key features of going of how you would get from here to there?
Well, the first premise that I made was not that we should build so many plants. It was the idea that the statement was made that based on the 1990 level of energy in the world, by 2050 we would need three times as much energy.
Okay.
And you can look at that both from the perspective of how much energy per capita, and if you take the developing world and you're really serious about development in the developing world, what you really need to do is to provide energy on a per capita basis that if they get up to about a third of what is used in the Western world average, the total amount of energy would be about three times. The other side of that coin, it was that by looking at three times the energy, you end up looking at what is effectively today 100%, or at least as of 1990, 100% of the energy at that time. So that if you argue that you can get nuclear to produce one-third of the energy, not just the electricity, but all of the energy, we would need 17 times as many plants as the equivalent plants that exist in the 1990s. And so that ended up coming up to about 6,000 plants.
Okay.
That's 6,000 equivalent plants. That is, those are 1,000 megawatt plants. Modular reactors would be smaller, and some of the large reactors that have been built most recently and the reactors that are planned in the future are in the 1,200 to 1,600 megawatt range. So when I say 6,000 plants, it's really 6,000 1,000 megawatt plants.
Right. Well, let's turn. There are more technical questions, and Jason or Betiana can jump in. But otherwise, I think Betiana might want to say from Buenos Aires right now a bit from her point of view in South America of what's going on in Argentina, but elsewhere, to promote this idea of resuming nuclear power.
Yes. Well, we have a kind of interesting process here because we have the religious movement all in Ibero-America. It's all joining forces to, well, let's say, and we have this nuclear international campaign. And, for example, we have visited in Argentina our nuclear power plant, Atucha 1, and Atucha 2, which is in the process of construction, and we think it's going to be finished in 4 years, more or less. And, well, the same thing has been happening in Mexico, for example. The LIM there, they visited Laguna Verde, its nuclear power plant in Laguna Verde, and the main idea is to get to know the processes involved in the construction, not only the physical construction of this kind of basic infrastructure that we need to mobilize our economy to a better level, but the whole process, the technical process, and well, as I was saying, the economic process. And also the main idea is to involve the youth in this this political fight, because it's our future we are talking about. So as a result of all this campaign we are working on since this late 2 to 3 months, we are mobilizing to organize a nuclear forum, which is going to be the 15th of June, and it's going to join through video conference the United States with Mexico City and Buenos Aires, and it's going to be open through webcast to the international community. And well, the first person who's going to speak obviously is going to be Lino LaRouche, because he's going to give the main idea of how this process of, well, the way the physical economy must adopt nuclear energy as the way to develop this process to how can I say it? We have this collapse of the international financial system, and it's something that most countries need to start preparing a policy. And Lyndon LaRouche, with his movement, his youth movement, is working to give this change of policy in the United States, so the whole world can realize that, well, the reality is that we have this financial problem, it is collapsing, and we need to change. We need a change of face in the economy. And the only way we can achieve that is through nuclear energy. The case of Argentina, for example, is that we have our petroleum resources are just for 9 years. So we have an urgent problem to solve. And the main problem is that we have, for example, well, let's say we have visited, for example, the National Energy Atomic Commission here, it's the main institution that we have here with the nuclear aspect. And in our several visits we have made, we were able to know different people who gave us this sense of what the generational problem is. We have a generation, the elder generation, who was part of this process of building a country and building the scientific aspect of a country through the economy. Because, let's say it's like what was happening in the United States with Roosevelt, and this was a paradigm shift, and it was spreading through the world. And well, this generation in Argentina could see this process, and well, the result of all that is that we could build this capacity of this scientific capacity of developing the nuclear energy in Argentina. And most countries in the world in the same situation of Argentina, well, don't have this possibility. For example, in Ibero-America, it's the main example. We have only Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina with this kind of development, scientific development in nuclear energy. And this generation, the elder generation, they could see the process, so they now see us and they see this the possibility of have a hope for the future. I mean, we are the youth and we are trying to intervene in this political situation, not only in our country, but trying to build the integration of Ibero-America. That's the main idea of this forum. And we, for example, The idea of the forum is not just join forces with the scientific aspect or the political aspect, but the youth has to be involved in the idea of building our future, because it's what we need now. We need to involve in the economy and get involved in the economy, and well, we are going to do another visit to Atucha, but we our idea is to establish, like, well, in the same way of this campaign, nuclear campaign, establish a way in which the youth, we organize in the streets, we organize in the universities, well, that they can be part of this process, they can step, because they have an idea of how nuclear energy, it's let's say, a rare idea. It's like the media hasn't been scientific in this aspect. We have the youth who is isolated from the reality. They give their thoughts about the reality and how it should be changed, how the politics are corrupted, and how the youth can do anything to change that. And the idea is that we are trying to change that kind of thinking in the youth, and that's the way the first thing they have to do is try to get involved in this forum, for example, to get to know how they can be the main factor to change the policy.
Oh, thank you very much.
To establish a tendency.
Sorry, Betiana, thank you. It's just we'll make a quick mid-show announcement right now, which we always do every week, and then we'll resume, including on that idea of how picking up on how their lies are out there about nuclear power. You mentioned it in terms of the media and so forth. And while I make this announcement, it is possible that Steve Jeffrey, who's a LaRouche Youth Movement leader who's been to the New York State Convention, the Indiana State Convention of the Democratic Party, may be calling in with just 5 minutes or so, literal on the road update from organizing here in the Midwest, in the industrial belt, in the same way that Betiana was just describing in Argentina. This is the LaRouche Show. It's June 3rd, 2006. We're weekly, and we are from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States from the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. You can, during the week, or in fact today, at any time, call this toll-free number in the United States to get information, to connect with this. It's 1-888-347-3258. It's 1-888-347-3258. And be sure and listen June 10th, 3 to 4. And you, at that time, can also, on the website, www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com, you can be directed to hear the June 9th webcast, which is at 1 o'clock, and check the same website by Mr. LaRouche. And also, keep that in mind, what Betiana from Buenos Aires has just said. June 15th, check the websites for information on this very important international nuclear policy conference on advancing nuclear energy technology. Now we have Steve on the line. I'm going to ask him to give Steve, could you give us some quick highlights before we turn to nuclear power of what it's like trying to change public opinion face to face at the Democratic Party conventions? Go ahead.
Yeah, you can hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, okay, great. What we were doing over the course of these two, I mean, we're actually en route to another one in Columbus right now.
In Ohio.
So we it's been pretty intense, and then the week of action following in Washington, D.C. But in both of these events, in Buffalo as well as Indianapolis, we opened the events with singing. Not on stage or anything, but what we did was we placed ourselves so that elected officials had to be forced to deal with something political on their opening night. The beer was not the only thing they got to do on the first conventions. But, and what was very efficient, everybody over the course of the entire Buffalo convention, from the moment through the singing,
I hope you're still connected. Maybe we have a dead spot. That's always the danger of someone speaking on the road. Go ahead, Steve.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. what we found, we got some intelligence from people that some people were sitting down in groups to read the legislation the night they received it. You know, we only, for the most part, saw them drinking. But apparently, we're actually at this politics. We had a very good response. We got multiple people signing on to what we would be advertising this coming week in Washington, D.C. I'm going to just keep it short because I have the feeling I could get cut off any minute. But, it was a very good response, completely open. Some of these things in the past, even just a few years ago in Indianapolis, we were, people with our movement were just kicked out of the event. So, literally thrown out. And so, we had a very good response from people, and I think the situation is wide open for this legislation to get passed.
Thank you very much, Stephen. We'll ask you back and report on these conventions in 2 weeks. So, Jim, in Massachusetts there, then let me direct to you questions that are posed by everyone's comments so far, namely that people in these organizing situations and young people are prepared to respond and look at the truth of nuclear power and not be sucked in by all these lies that it's dangerous, there's too much waste, and all this and that. Why don't you take a few minutes and lay to rest a myth or two, but could you just first begin with this one about nuclear waste? Forget it.
Well, nuclear waste is really the most manageable waste material that exists. The two elements that make waste hazardous are really trivial in the nuclear business. The first is that a material is released to the environment. And as we know, with many industries and certainly with other energy sources, primarily coal, oil, and gas, with combustion, great quantities of materials are released up stacks, quite intentionally releasing materials to the environment, which, because the stacks are tall, people argue and try work from the premise that the material is well dispersed and diluted, so it really doesn't constitute very much of a hazard. And yet with nuclear, the amount of radiation that is released from a plant, which could be characterized as waste, is essentially zero and is certainly a very small, less than 1% fraction of the local natural background radiation. At the same time, the other factor in waste is to be able to hold on to it in a form that is not subject to being dispersed, so that if you're retaining waste that are in liquid form or gaseous form or even coal mine tailings piles, and we've always heard of the kinds of accidents, the kinds of releases that come with these kinds of sources. In the case of nuclear, the material is simply a solid fuel rod, and the fuel rod can be taken out of the reactor and put into a spent fuel pool. And it continues to cool from all the radioactive products in it, and that material is actually reducing in its toxicity all the time. After a few years, the heat has gone down a lot, still deadly. But if you take it out of the pool, you can then put it in a cask of iron and steel that allows the heat to simply dissipate into the air. The heat is low enough at that point that it's a very simple draft process. The material is still a solid, and it's put into a nitrogen. They seal up the welded cask inside and essentially let it sit as it cools over time. The intent of moving it early to dispose of it deep underground has been an unnecessary step since it was first described as a way to respond to the policy that we wouldn't reprocess the fuel. The fuel itself is 97%, the spent fuel, is 97% uranium and plutonium, burnable fuel materials. 3% of the fuel in the spent fuel is actually fission product type of material that is separate from the fuel values. If you reprocess, as we did to recover plutonium in the days when we were making nuclear weapons, that material is then in a form that it can be solidified and has a very much higher degree of integrity than exists with any other waste material. Typically, it's put into a glass form, a borosilicate glass, which is simply a long-lasting, corrosion-resistant glass, which has been put in the earth and in flowing water and tested for the amount of corrosion that would happen over decades. And all the studies pretty much indicate that this is a very stable product. Now, when you assume that there can be some corrosion, that there could be some dispersion, the conclusion that was reached by the Academy of Sciences, the American Institute of Physics in 1977 in a report on this, was a statement that essentially said, there's no realistic way for the materials in a deep geologic situation to return to the biosphere in a concentration that would constitute a hazard to man or to wildlife. And so those small quantities that could return to Earth return to the surface are really very tiny contributions compared to what nature has already put in the earth under our feet.
Thank you.
On those terms, we see that this waste isn't a hazard, even if radiation were a hazard at very low doses, which is an issue that we disagree with entirely. The evidence does not show that. People and animals that live at higher levels of background radiation are healthier, have lower disease. There are real biological responses that are the reason. When you protect animals from radiation to below background radiation, they actually can get sick and die. And at very low levels, simply biology ceases to function.
Well, thank you. And Jason, you may have heard more, or this may be come up when you're organizing people at large in recent years, if you want to say something. Or otherwise, I think this puts it to rest. What do you think?
No, pretty much lays it. I mean, most of what people know or think they know about nuclear power comes from The Simpsons, so we don't have too much competition.
Right. One thing that's come up a lot, including before this show, is the question of how fast could plants be built? You can't take this outside the universe. We have a problem of inputs and getting certification and the rest. But Jim, do you want to comment on what a citizen needs to know if we can go ahead and gear up next week? How would we go about it? And how, if things were right, how fast can you build nuclear plants?
Well, to some extent, we don't and can't have an answer to that without doing a lot more work that the current institutional structure really is not prepared to do. What I said in the article was to point out that when it became important, you know, this is not a technical problem, it's really a political problem, and when it became important that the U.S. become a productive economy again, even during the Depression, one of the great examples is Roosevelt getting the Maritime Commission established and getting the job to Kaiser to build ships for the Merchant Marine when the U.S. was at a stage when it could build almost no ships in a market economy. And so at that point, they began to build the infrastructure to build ships. And we went from being able to build a ship in a year to the equivalent of building a ship every day. And the mechanics of that were simply to have the infrastructure of being able to deliver the manufactured steel and other materials to sites to build enormous shipyard capabilities to be able to build many ships at the same time. Any individual ship could be put together in a production capacity that was quite fast, but it was more important to build many in parallel than it was just how fast you could build any one. But their capability was developed from 1934-5-6 to the point where at the start of the war it was beginning to be productive in terms of ships, especially the Liberty ships. And we know the history of being able to turn on the technical infrastructure that existed at the time. And again, thinking of the middle of the Depression in 1935, to be able to build a capacity that could meet the need.
So you're talking about building a whole capacity, a potential, which, of course, is embodied in this emergency legislation that people have been talking about, that Steve Jeffrey just mentioned, that's being organized for at these conventions. On that score, from Jason, from your view at General Atomics or elsewhere, there's also, besides electricity, the question of other, you know, process heat, or did water desalination come up as something that you were briefed on in this visit to this R&D center?
Well, we asked about desalination. I mean, I think that they knew the processes involved that you could use for desalination, and they weren't doing any novel research in particular on the process of desalination itself. And one thing they were doing is they actually were doing like novel work on the process of breaking apart water to get the hydrogen out of it. So they had a little bit more on that. I mean, there's this process that involves sulfur and iodine, basically requires a high heat input to make it possible. And if you compare that to the kind of efficiency you get with electrolysis of just making using electricity to pull apart water directly, electrically, as opposed to doing it in this thermochemical way that they have, is just a tremendous increase in the ability to create hydrogen fuel, which is, I mean, which is what we need to do. I mean, there's no sense, you know, shipping large amounts of low value per pound petroleum around the world when you could be creating hydrogen locally, or take going on the ocean, desalinating water, and then making pulling the hydrogen out of that.
Can I make an observation on all of that?
Please.
What's critical in the idea of the iodine cycle and other bulk hydrogen production is that we can supply a large infrastructure with hydrogen because of those potential capacities. And yet, as we address the issue of getting into using hydrogen and beginning to need to have dispersed hydrogen supply, the real supply lines that already exist are in the wires that run over our head, and that electrolysis, while it produces much more expensive hydrogen per pound, and would certainly in the early days, can be readily dispersed, so that if you have a lot of nuclear electric capacity, instead of building the capacity to take a full plant, make tons and tons of hydrogen, but then have to disperse it in pipeline systems, et cetera, it's not just a matter of the cost of the hydrogen alone. And when it's not very concentrated in its use, the idea of building electrolysis units, even at the gas station, is an ability to begin the process of delivering hydrogen into an infrastructure that isn't yet built for hydrogen.
Do you want to say anything on that, Jason? That's this idea of location. That's tremendous.
Sounds good.
Yes. And, in fact, Jim, do you want to... That brings us to the idea of where you'd be... how you conceptualize where you put nuclear plants. You yourself have said, look at the intercontinental expanse of Eurasia, and you can imagine it there, how you'd want it across a Eurasian land bridge to encourage settlement.
Absolutely.
But is there anything wrong with at least being provocative and saying in the United States with only 103 nuclear plants, we have 26 brownfield sites, and why not build a few more there just because they're already? Is that too simplistic?
Oh, no. No, the first plants that are going to be built, and more than just the first in the sense of one or two, but the first dozens will probably be built at existing sites. And we have two kinds of existing sites that are important. One is the site where current operating reactors exist, and in most cases the local communities and the infrastructure to support the plants are in place. Electric systems have the transmission routes and cabling to be able to take the power out without building a lot of new transmission lines. With all of those kinds of advantages, clearly the early sites are going to be very important. Many of those early sites, when they were first selected in the 60s, were selected with capacities for multiple reactors. And as we know, in a lot of cases, even if there were just two reactors being built at the time, the site might have had room for six more, and yet even with the two, they ended up building just the one. And so those sites are very available. We also have some sites in which plants were started but then were abandoned some way down the road. Either nothing had been built yet, or in some cases plants were 80% complete but without the ability to sell all the power, and because the foresight of the political and economic system tends to be limited to a quarter, the idea that you would have gone ahead and kept those plants ready to be completed at a time when the power was necessary really said, hey, we'd have to put a lot of money into keeping this available. We don't know how to apply regulatory philosophy to recover that money. Clearly, if it were to go into the cost of the plant, it wouldn't actually get recovered until the time of the plant going online. And so those equations just didn't work, because we don't have the capacity to make policy decisions on rational bases instead of monetary bases.
Right. Well, I also want to acknowledge Robert from California has sent in several emails. One is concerning prospects towards fusion, which we can get to before the hour finishes. But back to the capacity question that's been raised, I just wonder, there, since we are talking about the industrial existence of the United States being on the line now with the threats of the dismantling of the auto and machine tool sector, what about the gear up for capacity? There are big deals like the pressure vessels, and Lyndon Blue from General Atomics once said maybe we should collaborate and Russia should produce those, whereas some of the other more smaller and more mundane inputs could still be produced by numbers of countries. Do you want to say something about that, Jim?
Yes, we today would be getting pressure vessels from outside the U.S. because we no longer have the ability to supply them. When we had to get pressure vessel heads to replace some of the PWR heads after the Davis-Bessey corrosion incident, those heads were generally built overseas. The large steam generators are built overseas. Spain, South Korea, Japan, other large industrial countries continue to have the capacity to build some of the more substantial parts of plants. The idea that we would have a collaboration where you'd say, well, Russia would build pressure vessels or could build pressure vessels, that kind of works if you think of building a few hundred plants. But if you're going to get serious about making nuclear a serious contribution to the energy needs of the world, you're really going to have several plants, because at the point that Russia came apart, they were building the capacity, which is an enormous facility, to build pressure vessels, and they were planning to build eight a year. Now, when we talk about having as many as 6,000 just to provide one-third of the world's energy, then we end up talking about getting up to a level of continuing building nuclear plants, say, after about 2035 or 2040, of 200 plants a year. So 200 plants a year is four a week.
So we have to make an entire shift, a domain change here. This jibes with what you're thinking, Jason?
Yeah, well, it jibes with the overall retooling. So, I mean, in terms of retooling auto, this is just one more, like one maybe pretty clear idea of the kind of direction we could take the country in, that, you know, from the base of having machine tooling, you're able to create further machine tools to be able to create whatever you do need to do to get ourselves back up to the ability to produce the kinds of major things that we would need to be able to make. This retooling of auto was well received by the people that we talked to at General Atomics as a policy for the United States to go with.
Did they say, uh-oh, that helps solve this or that? I mean, did they get into the specifics at all?
They did recognize that, this question about how we would build nuclear plants, they were saying, yeah, at first we're going to have to talk to Japan or Korea to get the bigger vessel components made there. But that, you know, they saw the ability to create fuel assembly lines, they could get those up and running pretty quickly, and as far as most of the other components, that we could get ourselves in the position to be able to make them again.
Yeah, I would agree with that a lot. One other observation, when I talk about a target of about one-third of the energy, it was really kind of a straw man, because if you think about it, it means that the other two-thirds, which is twice as much energy as we were providing in the 1990 time frame, would still therefore come from other sources, which means will the coal capacity jump to the level of 100% of the current coal, oil, and fossil fuels? But will that be 100% of the current level of energy use by 2050? In other words, even with this, there would have to be a substantial increase in fossil fuel use, and you could look at it and say, well, and let's say for a straw man, one-third coming from hydro and wind and all the other alternatives anybody can imagine, and you put down the gauntlet and say, how are you going to do this?
Right.
It may be that nuclear has one-third of the energy is not enough.
Well, I invite everyone to give all their attention, their resources, and their efforts this coming week to, there's a week of action in the United States in Washington, D.C. to force the issue in Congress. And taking up on the science, I think that compared to corn cob energy, which has been promoted recently by the big three automakers and some of the goer-alongers with this, I think if you have a nuclear reaction, you have something like 250 million electron volts connected with an episode compared to eight in a chemical reaction. That's the kind of difference we're talking about. So we can't just stay with fossil fuels in the way that Jim has just pointed out. But, you know, we only have a few seconds more, and I want to return to Argentina for Betiana to again say about the June 15th event and exemplify the meaning of changing the world's direction. Betiana, go ahead and you can end the show.
Okay. Well, yes, we are going to have this forum, nuclear forum, and the main thing is it's quite serious what we are talking about because, for example, we have this legacy in Argentina with the scientific legacy, and 10 years ago we have been developing the idea of a modular reactor also called CAREM, and we couldn't advance on that step to build this modular reactor because our state, our governments don't have the possibility, the financial possibility, since this whole process of globalization is set in these terms, this short-term terms. So now what we are creating, this join of forces, not only in Argentina, but with Mexico and the United States, gives the whole continent the possibility to give this phase shift to a better economy.
Thank you very much. I'm so sorry we're out of time, but I'm so glad to hear that this is happening June 15th. And you could all participate today. It's June 3rd, 2006. We're closing the LaRouche Show on nuclear power. And I thank Betiana Gonzalez and Jason Ross and Jim Muckerheide and Steve Jeffrey. And please tune in again June 10th from 3 to 4 p.m. And also listen June 9th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on www.larouchepub.com. Thank you all very much.